This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Immigration is a very contentious issue in the world today in several nations. And in the United States, we're seeing a showdown between the Trump administration and people who want the nation to basically have open borders. Besides masses of people protesting on the streets and in airports, you have states suing the president over his executive orders to enforce immigration law. You have judges who are undermining the administration's efforts. Cities that are saying, welcome illegals. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller to better understand the legal issues at stake and how dangerous this trend really is. Many people have criticized President Trump for his ties with Russia, but Trumpet writer Richard Palmer says that's not the alliance you need to be concerned about. We'll talk about the geopolitical forces that would prevent an American-Russian alignment, forces that are actually driving another nation into an alliance with Russia that is a good indicator of war being on the horizon. What do you want to do if you lose weight? Conventional wisdom for decades has been count calories. Don't eat too many calories. But there's a reason why 95% of the people who do that don't end up being successful at weight loss in the long run. It's true, you can't eat too many calories, but we're going to talk with nutritionist Jörg Mardian to see why you don't need to worry nearly so much about how many calories you're eating if you're eating good calories. And I'll conclude the program today with a word of advice from one of history's wisest men on how to handle haters. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Lawlessness is a very disturbing trend on the rise in America today. It's not just the fact that the murder rate is rising in America's cities and criminals are getting bolder, but particularly with the issue of immigration today, we see judges who are ignoring the limits of their position, taking authority that doesn't belong to them. We also see cities and even states that are refusing to enforce federal immigration laws. This is really part of a spirit of brazen lawlessness in this country. And the question is, what happens when we no longer respect the laws that are meant to govern us as a people? It's a very serious question, an important question. We're going to talk about it with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to have you. So January 30th, President Trump issued an executive order temporarily restricting the flow of refugees from seven countries that were known for exporting jihadists. But there are places where this isn't being enforced. Why is that?
Right. And actually, I think the order itself was probably issued a little bit before January 30th. But January 30th is definitely the date when the states of Washington and Minnesota sued the president, saying that they didn't think his order was legal due to a lack of a terrorist threat from Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Sudan, and Yemen. Those were the seven nations that Mr. Trump's order explicitly said no more immigration from these nations for the next 120 days until the federal government has time to review its vetting processes. After these two states sued, they had a judge, District Judge James Robert from Washington, who issued his own temporary restraining order, agreeing with the states that sued, Minnesota and Washington, that until the Trump administration provides concrete proof that there's a terrorist threat from these seven nations, it can't be enforced anywhere in the United States.
Yeah, and so what business does he have telling the president? What legally, what's going on here? And was the president justified in making that ruling? And what about the judge?
Right, and that's what most a lot of the pushback coming against this ruling is, people claiming that, well, actually there is a terrorist threat from Iran and Iraq and the other five nations, but which is true, although in some ways that kind of misses the bigger point, in that we have a federal district judge from Washington who now seems to think he's in charge of U.S. foreign policy. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, anyone who's passed their high school civics class should know that the government's broken down into Congress makes law, the president enforces law, and the courts make sure that neither of those two branches exceed their constitutional authority. Now, Congress passed a law in 1952 saying that the president has the power to temporarily ban any group of migrants he wants in the face of a national security threat. Mm-hmm. And so that's the job of the courts to rule is like, okay, is he within the confines of that law? Now, if President Trump would have tried to claim, for example, that I'm not going to allow any immigrants from these seven nations until further notice, that would have been something the courts could have struck down because now he's infringing on Congress's authority to make immigration law. But since he said
the 120 days, though, that was written into the law.
It was written into the law. So since he had a temporary 120-day ban until the federal government can review its vetting policies, he was well within his constitutional authority that Congress granted him in 1950, granted the presidency in 1952. The reason the Ninth Court struck this down is because, as we mentioned earlier, is they didn't think there was enough of a terrorist threat to warrant the president making that decision. But that's not for a judge to decide. The judge just decides, does the president have the legal authority to temporarily suspend immigration or does he not? He does, and it's up to the president to enforce the laws based on the advice and the counsel and the security briefings he's getting from the CIA and the NSA and all his other federal agencies whose job it is to determine, is there a threat?
And those agencies aren't providing those briefings to the judges of the Ninth Circuit.
Right. No, he's not in on the security briefings, and there are roughly over 1,700 federal judges now. So, I mean, do you use this like rule by committee where every time the president wants to make a foreign policy decision, he has to sit down with all 1,700 of these guys
right.
and make sure there's a unanimous opinion that this is the right thing to do?
Yeah, the implications of what this judge did and what the judges on the Ninth Circuit are doing is phenomenal and breathtaking. So we can see the implications of this go way beyond this one specific case, and it's hard not to view what these judges did really as another expression of the same hostility toward this administration and what he was doing as the mobs who were storming the airports and the streets in American cities and just saying, well, you know, we're not going to go along with this.
Right. And for kind of a unique quirk of coincidence, or maybe it's not coincidence, it's hard to tell, but it seems with the Ninth Circuit in particular, the judges always retire when a Democratic president is in office. And so it's definitely the new appointees have been far more to the liberal side of U.S. politics compared to any of the other appellate courts in America. And so that, and knowing that it was just being very common legal theory on the liberal politics to have what, like the evolving constitution where the judge is looking more towards, what's that like President Obama said when he appointed a Soyota Mayer to the Supreme Court, is he's looking more for someone who is empathetic and looking to their life experience to make decisions instead of just reading law. Mm-hmm. And so you've definitely see that with this judge where he thinks that this order is being discriminatory against Muslims in other countries. And so he's projected his political opinion onto the law instead of just reading, like, does the president have the authority to temporarily suspend immigration or does he not?
So you've written an article for the next print edition of the Trumpet magazine, the title, Must Cities Enforce the Law? And this is focusing on a related issue, the fact that we're seeing a rise in sanctuary cities. You've got areas within the United States where they're refusing to enforce immigration law, and they're actually actively encouraging illegal immigrants to come to these jurisdictions. You can have sanctuary here. Tell us about this and how this is also, this is maybe a little bit more legally thorny than this very blatant judicial overreach that we heard about, but same kind of trend that we're seeing in America.
Yeah, it's, well, it's definitely very similar to the Ninth Circuit ruling and the fact that, like, the radical left in America trying to keep borders open, letting Muslims from other countries come here without fear of any sort of travel ban, letting Hispanics from Mexico come here without having to do any of the legal paperwork or vetting process that you'd normally have to do for legal immigration. And as you said, there are definitely several very key mayors, Rahm Emanuel in Chicago, Bill de Blasio in New York, the mayor of San Francisco, who's in light of Trump, President Trump's pledge to deport illegal immigrants, have actually said, well, just come to my city and I'll make sure that you can stay, whether you're here legally according to federal immigration law or not. Like you said, it is a little thornier of a legal issue, to where with the Ninth Circuit ruling was just blatantly unconstitutional, almost like a judicial coup d'etat against the executive branch. This sanctuary city issue is that because the Constitution mandates that law enforcement, most law enforcement in America is a local issue, the federal government can't just commandeer local police forces to help them enforce federal law. Mm-hmm. And so for the most part, we relied on the Border Patrol and Homeland Security to enforce immigration law, but they're mostly concentrated on the border, trying to get them illegal immigrants as they come across. If they get past them and into the interior, they're here illegally, and the president has a constitutional responsibility to enforce the immigration law by deporting. It's just trickier. It's like, how do you actually do that? Mm-hmm. What they've done so far is they've asked the local police departments. They said, well, if you arrest someone for some sort of crime, check to see if they have paper, or check to see if they're here legally. And if they're not here legally, hold them in your jail cells for an extra 48 hours. Let the Department of Homeland Security know. The federal government will take care of the rest as far as the deportation process. Mm-hmm. Although, like I said, there's been over 600 counties, three dozen cities, and five states who've enacted laws saying that actually we're not going to comply with those requests.
Now, this is interesting because even though there may be some dispute over who is to enforce these laws, there's no one disputing the fact that those individuals are in the country illegally, and that they are violating the law, and that just executing the law would demand that they be handled a certain way. And these states are essentially saying, we will not enforce immigration law on the books. If they're saying welcome illegals, that's a fundamentally lawless position to take, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, definitely. The spirit behind it is that forget what federal immigration law is. If you can make it to my city, I'll make sure you're protected. The technicalities of how to deport them, they do right now, the main thrust of the confrontation is going to be over funding. The Trump administration standpoint is like, okay, well, granted, I can't force you to help us deport these illegals that you've arrested for some sort of crime, but we don't necessarily have to give you the billions of dollars in federal funding that we've been giving you either.
So this is the enforcement tool that the Trump administration has in its belt to be able to use against these
Jews. Is to cut funding, and he'll definitely be able to cut some. He could cut all of it if Congress actually passed an act regarding that. And if there isn't a congressional act, he probably won't be able to cut all whatever $27 billion in funding we know of that sanctuary cities receive from the federal government.
Well, let's just put this in the larger context because you know, a lot of this people could look at and just dismiss as some infighting between local and federal government. But this really does raise some powerful questions that really resonate in back in America's history Maybe you can just put this in the larger context and why this really is something that every American should be concerned about.
Right. And I think also the big thing is if you've got open borders, if you have cities that are saying they're not going to enforce law, going to help enforce federal law, then just about anybody could come into the United States. I mean, California's got a lot of these cities are right on the border. And if people are crossing into these cities and then the mayors of those cities are not helping with enforcement, once they're in, we don't have border checks between states. So they can come across here into any state whatsoever. And granted, I mean, a lot of the illegal immigrants coming from Mexico are legitimate refugees fleeing the drug war in their own country. But at least that we know of the 11 million illegal immigrants in America, about 7% of them have a criminal record. And mm-hmm. so that's almost a million people right there.
So, it's yeah, like you're talking
illegal
about
alien criminals who've come into the nation and are receiving sanctuary.
So, yeah, this would definitely have impact on crime statistics in the United States and criminality within American cities, especially these sanctuary cities. Donald Trump has talked about just how important it is to go after enforcement in these jurisdictions and these the individuals who are part of it. You have to ask, what is in it for these politicians? Why is it that they're encouraging this kind of this kind of behavior, and why do they want these people in their cities? I don't know. Do you want to talk about that at all before we close?
Yeah, well, it's always hard to, these numbers are always kind of in dispute, but I have seen a few what look like fairly credible reports that there were up to 2 million non-citizens who registered to vote last election. I don't know if all 2 million were actually able to vote, but they registered.
And I'm guessing that they didn't vote for Donald Trump.
No, I think that's the Donald Trump's mentioned a couple times that he thinks that the reason he lost the popular vote was due to illegal immigrants voting, and that might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but maybe not as much of an exaggeration as you'd like to think.
Yeah.
Because it's he lost the popular vote from like 4 million. All 4 million were from 4 million votes in California. And now you're looking at potentially 50% of that could have been illegal immigrants who were voting for whoever was going to give the best sanctuary or amnesty policies.
Well, this trend of lawlessness is one that we followed for quite some years at thetrumpet.com. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has written quite a bit about it. He wrote a book called No Freedom Without Law that includes a chapter about the evolving Constitution and some of the judicial activism that we saw even like 10, 12 years ago. A really good booklet to go and take a look at. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this trend of lawlessness in America. He has an article up at thetrumpet.com right now called Ninth Circuit Coup d'Etat about that recent decision. And this week, we're also finishing up the April edition of the Trumpet magazine. He has an article slated to go in that issue called Must Cities Enforce the Law about the sanctuary city issue. You can watch for that article on thetrumpet.com. Fascinating subject, Andrew. I'm sure it's going to become a bigger issue in the time ahead. We'll keep our eyes on it. We appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
One of the most talked about issues surrounding the presidency of Donald Trump is his ties with Russia. How close is he to Vladimir Putin? Will he ally with Russia? Trumpet writer Richard Palmer says, don't worry, it won't happen. What you really need to worry about is another relationship Russia is forging, not with the Trump administration, but with another nation altogether. He's written an article that is slated to go in the next print edition of the Trumpet magazine. It's called The Russian Alliance You Really Have to Worry About. We have him via Skype from England. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So first, I want you to explain why you feel like the concern over a potential Russian-American alliance is overblown.
Well, in our international relations course here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, one of the first things our textbook kind of criticizes is getting wrapped up too much in individuals. And I think that's exactly kind of what the media has gone through in this case. Now, there are a lot of occasions where individuals matter, but alliances tends not to be one of them. What you need to look at rather than individuals is interests. What are America's interests? And nations that have similar interests are going to work together and they're going to form more longer lasting and better quality alliances. Nations with opposing interests, they may have some nice feelings about each other. There may be some good words. There may be some pleasant photo opportunities, but that alliance just won't stick. And when you look at Russia and when you look at the United States, they have their alliances fundamentally, when you look at their core alliances, they don't really complement each other at all. And that's why you never really have seen a Russian-American alliance. I mean, the big exception, of course, is World War II, where there was just this immediate, very obvious and clear threat of Nazis trying to take over the world that was literally invading Russia and declaring war on the United States at the same time. And so there was almost like a forced alliance then. But apart from that immediate necessity, when in all of history has there ever been an alignment in these two nations? There hasn't. And that is because their needs, their place in the world mean that they have very different interests. And so they very rarely get together. And so regardless of what Mr. Trump's intentions are, there's not really the basis for a good deal here.
Well, it seems like there would be some level of alignment that certainly they, you know, like Mr. Trump has basically said, look, it would be a good thing if the two of us got along. But let's get into some of the specifics about what you're looking at in terms of national interests and why, say, America's interests and Russia's interests would be so different.
Right. And I think there is potential for, say, a little bit of working together. So, for example, Donald Trump has talked about maybe splitting Russia away from Iran and then America working with Russia and the Islamic State against Islamic State. That might be possible. What won't happen is this kind of earth-shaking realignment where the United States and Russia suddenly kind of become close friends on a long-term basis and just this whole, you know, what Europe really feels, this rebuilding of the world axis around Russia and German, or Russia and American alliance. So America's number one top interest is to prevent a unified power occupying a good chunk of the continent of Eurasia from arising. Because if that happens, that is a threat to America's survival. And you can look at well-grounded American thinkers across the decades, and this has constantly been what they've highlighted as the key threat. And, George Friedman over at Geopolitical Futures has pointed to this. We have a quote from Nicholas Spykman, who was a really top-notch thinker on international relations during the 1940s. And he said that our constant concern in peacetime must be to see that no nation or alliance of nations is allowed to emerge as a dominating power basically either in Eastern Europe or East Asia. So that's America's top interest. Meanwhile, what's Russia's top interest? Well, Russia's top interest is Eastern Europe, to push as far into Eastern Europe as they can, because they've been invaded quite a few times from the West. They've almost been destroyed, and it's that extra space that has saved their national existence. At the moment, as quick as I am to kind of stand up for Ukraine and criticize Russia's actions there, you can see why Russia is doing what they are doing. If Hitler had invaded Russia on Russia's current borders, they would have lost World War II. They would have been annihilated. Their history, world history, would have been entirely different. They need, for their survival's sake, to guard themselves against any future aggressor to push eastward. So America's core interest: stop Russia pushing eastward so there's not a unified power on the continent. Russia's core interest: push eastward. A fundamental contradiction. They're simply not compatible. And so when you start to look at the kind of the give and takes that America might be able to come up with Russia for an alliance, you know, Russia would need a lot from America to make an alliance work, to make it worth their while turning their backs on China and some of those other alliances and Iran and those other alliances that they've created, while the United States cannot possibly give them much, because if they do, they risk making Russia their number one threat and kind of cementing them as the top challenger to the United States. So when you look at interests, it just there's no real way that they could be a deep and long-lasting alliance there.
You know, we've talked about just how concerned Eastern Europeans are to see this alignment between the Trump administration and Vladimir Putin. And really, what you're saying, it kind of underlines that fear. It's not so much that they're afraid of an alliance, but all America has to do in order to allow Russia to begin to pursue its interests more robustly is just kind of pull back. It's not really so much of a friendship as just a failure to provide the kind of check on Russia that it really needs. So based on these current geopolitics and on history, you mm-hmm. say that the nation that we really have to be concerned about Russia allying with is Germany. So let's first talk about the pressures that are right now causing an alignment in Russian and German interests.
Right. So you've got a lot, there's a whole load of ways where these two interests overlap. In terms of Germany's interest right now, they're fairly secure. They're in terms of their core interest. Their number one interest historically has been to not be encircled, to not have two allies attacking them from both sides, basically. And you know, France is in the European Union. Realistically, they do not need to fear an attack from France. There is some hostility from Russia, but at least they're not surrounded.
Right.
So that's kind of taken care of. And economically, they're doing quite well as well.
That would also explain, say, Germany's interest in trying to preserve the status quo in Eastern Europe. That would explain some of the hostility between Russia and Germany, just in Germany trying to keep that border where it is rather than letting it push westward.
Yes, absolutely. Keeping some distance between them and Russia is very helpful. I think more importantly for Eastern Europe is their core kind of economic interest, which is they need to keep the euro together. They want to keep the EU together because, just as Donald Trump has pointed out, they gain a huge trade advantage from that. And they gain a lot of economic advantages from the euro. And if there is given the very precarious state of their politics right now, if the euro if their economy starts stalling, they face massive political upheaval, etc. So they really need to keep, it's not their top interest, but another very important interest is for them to keep the euro together. And I think that is what has been behind a lot of their hostility to Russia, right? So far, partly to preserve their alliance with the United States, but partly to try and hold this bloc together that includes a lot of Eastern European nations whose main reason they joined the EU in the first place is some protection against Russia. So that's what they're doing so far. But you look at Russia, and they have a lot of potential overlapping interests without compromising those core interests. So they're not going to compromise encirclement because France, if anything, is more enthusiastic about a Russian alliance than German politicians are right now. Then their economic interests, they have a lot in common. Russia really needs a lot of Western technology, manufacturing know-how. And Germany has that. And Germany actually wants to export more. And on the other hand, Germany has a lot of need for commodities and for raw materials, which Russia has in abundance. And that's why you've seen an economic alliance between Russia and Germany over the last 200 years even. And you look at whenever Russia has needed to modernize, whether it's militarily or industrially, it has tended to turn to Germany. And they've worked together historically, just even economically that way. Then you look at the Middle East. And all of Germany's concerns about the Middle East and about radical Islam and the immigration crisis, well, Russia's positioned itself perfectly to be a partner for Germany in solving those problems. And then even the euro crisis, Russia has some levers there. It has some influence in Greece. It has some influence in Cyprus. The one major danger is just how Germany moves closer to Russia while keeping the euro and the eurozone together. That would be the biggest challenge, and that would be the biggest interest that would be threatened by this. But it's not a core interest, There are other, perhaps this an economic relationship with Russia could make up for that. And done with skill and done very carefully, I think Germany could draw closer to Russia without alienating Poland and breaking up the European Union. But that challenge is why it hasn't happened yet, I think. So it's not completely plain sailing, but a lot of complementary interests and a lot to benefit from.
But looking at this list of interests that you've just given us, it does strike me just how much, say, the alignment between them would be a more short-term interest, and that you could see in some of these areas really evolving quickly into a source of great conflict between these two countries as well. As much as there may be some short-term alignment, for example, if you look at the way that Russia is handling its business in the Middle East, you could see them having fundamentally different aims, say, than Germany would have in that region. And though they may have to come together in order to find some way to some accommodation to find a common solution, it wouldn't actually hold up under pressure.
Absolutely. Yes, it is. It's they're not sitting down and singing Kumbaya together. it's a short term alliance of convenience. And I think the thing that really kind of is giving this an extra shove is Mr. Trump's withdrawal from the world and his promised mm-hmm. withdrawal from NATO. And if you look at what Hans J. Morgenthau kind of wrote about this, writing about the situation towards the end of the Cold War, and I think a lot of what he wrote there seems very prescient, where he basically says, you know, America was involved in Europe to balance Russia. If it starts moving backwards and withdrawing from that balance, everything unbalances. The whole balance kind of tilts in favor of Russia, and suddenly everybody has to kind of scramble and reorganize. And if
pretty
Mr.
much
Trump
exactly
follows,
what we're seeing right
exactly
now.
The same kind of yep. scrambling. And at the moment, Europe cannot really militarily stand up to Russia. I think there are a lot of ways that Europe is more powerful than Russia. Its economy is vastly bigger, but Russia is unified. The European Union is divided. Russia has a strong military. Europe is still working on building those. So, like you were saying,
Russia has a strong man, and Germany doesn't at this point. They have somebody who's willing to use that power to its most effective advantage. Just before we finish, I just like to look at the historical aspect. We've seen these two nations, Russia and Germany, ally in the past, and the effects haven't been so positive. This is something that we've drawn attention to at the Trumpet from time to time over the years. Maybe you can just tell us about that.
Yeah, it's something that has cropped up again and again. So you had towards the end of the 18th century, Prussia, Austria, and Russia, the three of them just kind of sat down and decided to slice up Poland between them, share it out there. Then, as I mentioned, during that period of modernization, Germany helped modernize Russia's army after this, and even to the point that Germany was forced to ally with Napoleon, but a whole load of German officers decided they'd rather keep fighting with Russia because they hated Napoleon so much. And I put in this article just a little anecdote from Tolstoy that I always love, where he notes in War and Peace that one of Russia's generals was so angered by how much power and influence the Germans had in the Russian army that he asked the emperor if he could be promoted to the rank of German. So there's a kind of an alliance with Russia going there. And then when Bismarck was unifying Germany once again, well, he said the secret to politics is a good alliance with Russia. And he really worked hard to make sure that Russia was on Germany's side. He saw that as being a vital importance to Germany's place in Europe. The way he saw it was if Germany was fighting Russia, you know, other nations could join in with Russia. Germany would be weakened and ultimately defeated, allied with Russia, and that alliance would reign supreme. So he followed that. Germany didn't follow that advice during World War I, got defeated. So as they built up towards World War II, just even as they were building up, you had the Rapallo Treaty with Russia that helped them kind of come back from World War I. And then finally, this Hitler-Stalin pact, where the two of them once again decided to divide up Eastern Europe, kind of for the second time, because it wasn't until after World War I that Eastern Europe kind of emerged again from the first time that Germany and Russia divided it between the two of them a couple of hundred years earlier. So something you see again and again, Eastern Europe getting divided up by these two major power blocks.
And essentially, you see the conditions that lead to world war being exactly the factors that drive Germany and Europe into each other's arms. And that alignment between them really, historically speaking, it looks like this is really a predecessor of war breaking out on a massive scale.
That's right. And it reminds me a bit of an article Geopolitical Futures put out just a bit ago, where they were talking about how, what was it, the world before World War II reemerges. And they were saying, look, we can't make many specific predictions, but what we can say is there's a whole lot of instability out there, and this kind of instability tends to lead to war. And you know, without the Bible, I think you can see that with the Bible, we can make much more specific predictions, but that's exactly what you see. And those same kind of instabilities and uncertainties and alliances mean that you get these shifting alliances and Germany shifting to Russia, but it's that same kind of conditions that make war more likely.
Yeah, that's a great point, and we are thankful that we have that sure word of Bible prophecy in order to guide us through as we watch these alliances form and break. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the trouble with a Russian-German alliance. He's written an article slated for the April edition of the Trumpet magazine. It's called The Russian Alliance You Really Have to Worry About. We also have quite a lot of literature along with that. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com, but also booklets like Russia and China in Prophecy and The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. Excellent booklets to look at in order to guide you in understanding just what's happening with these nations. We always appreciate your time, Richard. That's really a great subject to look into and something we'll keep our eyes on.
Great. Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
If you want to lose weight, is counting calories necessary? Maintaining a healthy body weight definitely means not eating too many calories, but nutritionist Jörg Mardian says there are problems with calorie counting, mostly because not every calorie is the same, and it matters what kind of calories you're eating. I have Jörg here via Skype from his office in British Columbia. Hello, Jörg.
Hi there.
So where did the idea of calorie counting as the path to weight loss start?
Well, it crept its way into the American conscience somewhere in the 1920s. And there was a book written. It was the first book on calorie counting. And it was written by Lulu Hunt Peters. And she didn't know it at the time, but it was to be a bestseller immediately. She wrote it in such a style that, Americans just gobbled it up, and I think it sold close to 2 million copies. It was called Diet and Health with Key to the Calories, and she wrote it in a very engaging style. And immediately what drew me to it is a statement she made. And she said, a person can eat what they like, candy, pie, cake, fat, meat, butter, cream, but they need to count the calories. So I looked at that statement and I said, wow, that's a lot of food, but, you know, candy and pie. So right at the very beginning, when this crept into the American conscience, you see this restrictive eating craze starting by elevating the counting of calories above food quality.
So how well does it work? Has this ever really been effective?
Counting calories? Not really. I mean, it's got an atrocious record. So roughly 70 years later, you can look at the American Journal of Medicine, and they said between 1980 and 1990, people were consuming about 4% less calories and 11% less fat. So it was quite the experiment. And in fact, overall fat-free consumption rose from 19 to 76%. So despite this, despite all of that, during the same period, obesity in the U.S. increased by 31%.
We're eating fewer calories, but the waistline is still expanding.
It was expanding, yes. And the authors actually called this the American paradox. They just didn't understand what was happening because it was supposed to work. Now, about 90 years later, you know, to our current time here, this notion that the calorie restriction still works is still put to shame because we're hovering around 95% failure rate, according to studies. So, it's so bad that...
You mean 95% of the people who count calories don't end up actually losing weight because of that?
The long-term success rate. Right. I mean, you can definitely, if you restrict calories, you're going to get an effect. But the long-term success rate on that is 95% failure.
Yeah. Not so good. And we tend to see thin as healthy, fat as unhealthy. But what you're saying, you say that basically the truth is a little more complicated than that.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, we do look at overweight. I mean, there's certainly something out of balance. I mean, the human body isn't meant to just put on 100 pounds. You're walking around, you're out of balance. That's obvious. But it doesn't mean that a person who's thin is automatically healthy. If you're eating, if you have just a crazy metabolism and you eat nothing but junk food, you're not going to be healthy, and your insides are not going to be healthy. You can get a heart attack just as fast as anybody else. So calories are important in an overall sense for maintenance or fat loss. Of course they are. Nobody will deny that. What the experts are saying is that it's the food quality that's more important than counting the calories. So if you count 400 calories of Twinkies and 400 calories of vegetables, who would you say would have a longer lifespan? Or who would you say would remain healthy over the next 4 weeks?
Right.
It's pretty easy.
So the way that the woman wrote when she first wrote about this, she said basically calories are calories and you can eat whatever you want. You mentioned candy and pie. But clearly the quality of food that we're putting into our mouths determines the quality of our health overall. There's definitely a difference in the quality of the calories that we're eating. So maybe it's more of a combination. We need to look at quantity and quality.
Yes. I mean, in the long run, moderation is still the most basic of terms. In anything we do, if you're out of moderation, you're going to gain weight. It doesn't even matter if you're eating so-called healthy foods, you can still become overweight. So if you overeat on nuts or too much dairy or, you know, things like that. The difference between the healthy and the unhealthy, though, is how the hormones in a body react. Yeah. So Dr. David Ludwig, he's the author of the book Always Hungry. He said, think of obesity in terms of what makes us overeat. And he said, when you're gaining weight, something triggers your fat cells to store too much energy. And it doesn't leave enough for the rest of the body. So that something is often the hormone insulin, which reacts to that processed food. So when your body's insulin response is out of control, cutting back on calories actually makes the problem worse. So now generally, there's no one food nutrient to blame for insulin trouble if you're eating whole food calories, if you're eating a healthy diet. But Dr. Ludwig correctly singles out refined grains and starches, especially sugar, as the principal drivers of hormonal problems. So I'll give you an example. You can actually override the hormone that makes you feel satiated. So if you're eating chips, you can eat an entire bag of chips very, very easily, and you process that food so fast that your brain can't even think about how many calories you're getting. So it actually shuts off the satiating feeling. And another thing about processed food is that they make them now so that they actually almost melt in your mouth, and the brain doesn't have time to react to that. And these are very devious ways for these manufacturers to get us to eat more. So we just don't have that signal to say, hey, stop that. You know, if you eat three apples, you're going to gag.
Right.
You're not going to want to eat more apple. You could possibly eat three bags of chips.
Huh. Just the way that they're manufactured, it's actually triggering our brains to fail to register what's passing into our bodies. We're not feeling full from that food, and we're not registering the fact that we're overloading ourselves with certain kinds of calories as a whole or ingredients that are going to hurt us.
Right. It's that intense taste and texture that creates the food addiction. So the brain just doesn't know how to override that. So it puts the brakes on the hormone signals for being full. It slows down our metabolism. It causes thyroid hormones to drop. And I think we previously discussed that on a program. Cortisol levels rise, and that activates fat storage enzymes. So the end result of eating so low-calorie, hyper-processed foods is excess fat storage. See, it doesn't matter if we have low calories, because most people, when they go on a low-calorie diet, they read labels. Where is a label? A label is on a processed food. A label is not on an apple.
Right.
An apple doesn't need a label. In fact, most whole foods are low calorie anyways. Most, I say.
Uh-huh. So yeah, go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is, if you're eating a whole food diet, if your diet is mostly from foods that are not in boxes and cans, you actually don't have to count calories. I've never counted calories with myself or my clients, ever. It just used the adage of, make sure that it's a very good food and make sure you don't overeat. So those are two very important points.
Okay. So you're talking about an approach to weight loss or maintaining a healthy weight that is sustainable in the long run, and it accounts for this the problem with the idea of just looking at your weight just as a single number to determine your health. This is making sure that you're putting in the nutrients that your body actually needs. You're going to be healthy on the inside and probably maintain a good weight.
Right. So you hit the nail on the head there. Nutrition is the key. If we're simply counting calories, we're just too preoccupied at most times to think about nutrition. And it's the reason that these diets fail is that we're weighing, we're measuring, we're obsessed with our little cups of food. But we're not obsessed about the nutrition content of the food. We're not obsessed about the chemicals and the additives and that. And that's really what's causing our problems. So, yes, we can be on an 800 to 1200 calorie diet. But the worst of both worlds is we don't get enough calories for the body to meet its demands. And we don't get enough nutrition. And so we fall sick. And that's just a long-term recipe for disaster. You're going to fall off the wagon there very easily.
So let's just talk about nutrition a little bit. What the body needs. You were talking about earlier the hormonal response within the body to certain kinds of processed foods and insulin spikes and so on. What do we need to put in nutritionally, and what sort of positive hormonal reaction would the body have to the foods it actually needs?
Right. So when we're eating foods, you need to make sure that you have your macronutrient ratios are there at every meal. A lot of authors say, look, don't eat any carbohydrates. That's nonsense. Make sure they're whole grain carbohydrates. But make sure that you're also getting some meats in with that meal. And make sure that you're getting your vegetables and a healthy amount of or a good amount of healthy fats. What I teach clients then is that you're getting a good mix of the macronutrients that you need at every meal.
Macronutrients, we're talking protein, we're talking carbohydrate, we're talking fat.
And fats, yes, and the grains are in there. So we want to make sure that the grains, if you're eating meats and fats with them, it actually slows down the absorption of those, and it prevents that massive insulin response. So what I do with clients, I just say, don't overeat the grains. I mean, if we're eating cereals all the time out of boxes and such, those are a really bad way to cause excess blood sugar. But if you're eating cooked cereals, those are very, very good for you, and they have a normal release of blood sugar, and then the insulin responds to that, right?
Okay. So insulin response, are there other hormonal responses that we ought to be concerned about or that might factor into doing this the right way?
Well, yes. Like I said, you have your thyroid as well, which a lot of people suffer from. Cortisol levels, they rise. So we have to be careful that all of these are triggered by processed foods. And what happens is that the processed food actually causes the calories to store in fat rather than being used by the organs. So where normally the body would say, look, I'm going to give a certain amount of body fat because we do need that body fat. Processed food causes more of those calories to store within body fat. So the body really doesn't know how to handle that. So all that does, the processed food, it just activates the fat storage enzymes. And then if you see somebody walking around and saying, look, I'm 100 pounds overweight, that's a lot of processed food. Usually when we talk about genetics, that's only about 2%, 1 to 2% of the population. The rest really is we're looking at a food quality issue. So when you're going into your supermarket, I always teach people, make sure you go on the outside and get those natural foods first, the whole foods, rather than the inside aisles where you're going to get caught with the boxes and the cans.
Yeah. Very good practical instruction there, Jorg. We appreciate that. We've been talking with registered holistic nutritionist Jorg Mardian about calorie counting, why it's not the way to go when you're trying to lose weight. Be much more concerned about the quality of the food that you're putting into your body than just specific caloric amounts. But he's written an article on this subject. You can find that on thetrumpet.com within the next couple of days. Jorg, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Do you care too much about what other people think of you? We all want to be liked, and that's not necessarily bad. It can motivate us to eliminate annoying habits and to treat other people well, but it can easily become a problem. We all risk putting too much value on others' opinions, especially negative opinions. And with social media, this tendency has gotten a mega rocket boost. People obsess over managing their online reputations, the number of followers and friends and favorites and likes and so on. And online, people tend to spout off mean, nasty comments pretty freely. Absorbing yourself in that noisy, ugly world can give you terrible insecurity. It can distort your decision-making, destroy your confidence, even your faith. If you've ever fallen into these traps, here's some great advice from a very wise man who understood a lot about human nature long before any of us picked up a smartphone. King Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 21, "Take no heed unto all words that are spoken, lest you hear your servant curse you." Okay, so you don't have any servants, but think about Solomon's point. He's addressing your attitude toward what others say about you, and particularly criticism. Don't go asking around for what people are saying, he advises. Don't be over-anxious about their evil reports. Don't be curious to hear how they judge you, whether in person or online. Here's the thing. When you go fishing for comments, you're looking for praise. You want to hear good things, things that, frankly, just appeal to your vanity. So even if you get what you want and you do hear praise, it's not necessarily good for you. But as this verse says, that probably isn't what you'll hear. If you're snooping around trying to learn what people really think of you, you're going to hear something bad. And that's an excellent reason not to snoop. This verse says there are things that you're actually better off not even hearing. When you overhear that cutting comment, what can you do about it anyway? It's only going to frustrate you and upset you. Like it or not, people will curse you. That's life. So what? Solomon says, take no heed. Even when you do happen to hear a nasty remark, the verse says, do not take to heart everything people say. In other words, act like you didn't even hear it. Now, obviously, you need to hear constructive criticism. We all need correction. We need to be correctable. We need to be willing to make changes that make us better people. Solomon isn't saying to be deaf toward that. He's saying ignore snippety, gossipy chatter. And in our hyper-connected world, there's a lot of that flying around, and it's easy to take offense at the slightest thing and turn pinpricks into civil wars. The next verse, Ecclesiastes 7, verse 22, gives more wisdom that puts other people's comments in perspective. It says, your heart knows that many times you have yourself cursed others. Admit it. You've said bad things about others, things you hope they don't hear. You shouldn't have, but you have, and so have I. When you hear someone saying something bad about you, instead of getting upset, take it as an opportunity to reflect on your own mistakes in that area. Check your emotions, then think about how you've criticized others, and then strengthen your resolve to avoid backbiting and gossip, and to protect other people's reputations. In Titus 3, the Apostle Paul wrote, speak evil of no man, for we ourselves also were sometimes foolish. We all make mistakes. It's easy to judge others, but there are plenty of things about you that could be condemned just as easily. Remember that, and you'll have more patience for the guy who says something unflattering about you. Most all of us need to be less concerned about what other people think and more concerned about what God thinks. Paul wrote in Galatians 1, am I now seeking the approval of man or of God, or am I just trying to please man? He said, if I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ. Follow Solomon's excellent advice. It's sure to spare you a lot of nonsense and heartache. When it comes to negative comments, don't listen to the haters. Listen to Solomon. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. You can send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Jörg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Epictetus. Fortify yourself with contentment, for this is an impregnable fortress. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.